myself that took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their houses for 10 years.
All right, so welcome along to the best of 2020. Probably a year we could forget, Conor, if we're being honest, but we're going to do the best of anyways and look back on it fondly. Conor, are we capable of looking back on it fondly?
I think so. Are we digging too much into detail about the old matches we watched back in March and April? I think we have plenty of stuff to talk about, including some good stuff as well, even though it wasn't tough here.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, this year, let's just talk about this year first, because this year, before we get into the best of, because it's, I was going to say Happy New Year to you, but like, I mean, it hasn't been a very happy new year. We're looking at David Clark gone, Donal Vaughan gone, Tom Parsons gone, Seamus O'Shea gone. The list could go on and on. I'm thinking maybe 7 or 8 could be jumping off the ship here, Conor.
Yeah, I was about to say that sound you can hear in the background, Willie, is a Mayo player furiously typing his retirement statement as we speak. by the time this goes out, there could be 5 or 6. It nearly seems, I doubt this, but it nearly seems like it's coordinated that they do a day apiece, and that they can nearly wallow in all the the tributes that are going to be poured their way, sent their way every day. But like when none of them are, you know, individually none of them are a surprise, but it's nearly like a domino effect now. And you think that whether it's their own decision, which I imagine it was, but maybe they've also chatted to James Horan and he's very clear on the new direction he wants to go in. And it doesn't involve a lot of the old stalwarts that have served Mayo so well for the last couple of years. So while there's been 4 already, I don't think it's going to stop at 4, Willie. I think you mentioned 7 there. I think that could be right by the time that Mayo are ready to go again this year.
Yeah, Seamus O'Shea and Donal Vaughan were very obvious ones. They had been kind of frozen out. They didn't get any real game time. Didn't get any game time, I'm fairly sure, this year. David Clark was starter. That was probably more surprising. And Tom Parsons got on the field. So, look, I suppose in their head psychologically, you know, after the year that was in it, they got to the All-Ireland again. They lost it again. Now they see, you know, they're moving in another direction. It seems like a natural end for all of them, if we're being honest. Like, I mean, and that, to be fair, in another year, this would be a big shock for Mayo. And funnily enough, it's not a big shock because the great work James Horan has done this year has kind of, you know, almost prepared Mayo people and the squad for this, which was always going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've been talking about this since the first championship game. I mean, there was huge shock, let's say, when none of like Colin Boyle, Keith Higgins, any of the lads you mentioned there, Tom Parsons, Donal Vaughan, Seamus O'Shea, weren't involved at the start. But we gradually, I'd say by the time the All-Ireland semi-final came around, we came to the realization that, like, well, this is the direction. It's not as if he's been sparing them or saving them for the big game. This is the direction that James Horan is going to go. So it's not as if they, like, any of the retirements are a surprise. But I suppose my only thing on it, Willie, is that, like, while none of them obviously were involved in not many were involved in the playing squads for the league and the championship, is that I'm sure they've had an absolutely massive impact even this year behind the scenes, and that, like, losing so many of them, so much of them at once, I'd just be afraid of the impact that might have on the kind of the culture in the Mayo dressing room and the standards that they've set so far, because all 4 of them have been huge drivers in kind of the culture and making Mayo reach the level that they've gotten the last few years. So obviously the players that have served under them, and it's up to maybe the lads in their mid-20s now to step up and to become their leaders, and they would have learned off them in the last couple of years. But I just hope that not having these lads around the dressing room, you know, isn't going to lead to any sort of complacency or any sort of drop in standards, because, as I said, they would have been huge drivers of that for the last decade, basically.
Yeah. Well, I think Aidan O'Shea, Killian O'Connor, Lee Keegan, and these fellas are of similar kind of stature as those fellas, but they'll still be able to drive it. Three retirements in Kerry, Shane Enright probably being the big one in that, and Stephen McDonald, Cork hurler, has retired as well. So it's definitely the season for retirements. They're the ones I saw anyways. Right, this is a best of 2020 show, Conor, so we'll get straight into it. And a big part of last year was obviously lockdowns. The first one came in March, and it was a disaster because we had no sport, and we thought that we might all die probably when we were back in last March. Everyone was in a big worry and we were furiously washing our hands, and that was the whole story. And we had to make up shows by analysing old All-Irelands. And then after those shows, we did some tribute shows, and they went down really well. We started off our first tribute show with our own JJ Delaney. Brian Cody joined the call. It's not often you get Brian Cody in great form, but I think his love of JJ Delaney kind of brought out the best in him.
But I would always attend that I've never seen a better defender than JJ. And I think it was fairly... the same opinion would have been there within our panel the whole time with all the players. Like, I mean, they would always rate JJ as just being way up there. I mean, for me, he just was the ultimate defender because, I mean, you can talk about hurlers and players and attackers and defenders, but there's a phenomenal art of defending that maybe sometimes forgotten about completely, and players can stand out and play magnificent games, maybe do a few lovely things, maybe pop over a couple of pints even. But, I mean, maybe they're not, the actual defensive part of their game is not as it should be. But JJ just guaranteed that every single time. His ability to kind of, his ability to defend was absolutely everything. He could, his anticipation was perfect. He had a brilliant hand, superb in the sky, brilliant ability to stop players winning ball in the sky. His one thing that probably stood out for him was if he weren't first to the ball, his ability to just get in a flick on a ball. Touch to flick the ball away, to deny the man possession of the ball. I mean, every forward wants instant possession of the ball, but JJ had an uncanny ability to deny the forward instant possession of the ball, which gave him the advantage always. And he also had that kind of I wouldn't say a mean streak, but I could have wanted, I suppose. He was totally, totally fearless, and he could play on whatever terms the game had to be played on. He was well capable of doing it.
Brian, I'm slagging him about only scoring 1 point in 66 performances. What's your thoughts on that?
To be honest, I'm surprised he scored 1 point.
That's including Brian as well, Brian.
No, it wouldn't have been. JJ wasn't one of these flamboyant players. I mean, that's probably what made him so outstanding. He wasn't flamboyant. He was totally efficient. It was never a question of thinking about, I'll do something magical, I'll do something that. His main priority at all times, like he's more or less said, was he was to defend. He was a defender, deny the man possession, win the ball, get it back, get the team on the attack. And he's, I mean, that's the player he was, and I can't remember that point even. I'd love to have a think about games.
He was telling us here that it was against Offaly in Amore Park, and if there was a Hawkeye in Amore Park, he might not really even have gotten that point.
it was probably a Welsh Cup game, I'd imagine, if there was no pressure.
A championship game, worry, so
nice.
We were in trouble at the time.
I can imagine, yeah, a rallying score.
A rallying score, JJ, Cody says, Connor. Like, I mean, it's not often you hear Cody kind of laughing. Almost kind of, like, you can just tell how much he loves JJ. And like, I mean, I'd never get Brian Cody on the show. It's impossible to get Brian Cody outside of a media day. And on a media day, you would never hear him laughing. I can guarantee you that. But when he's on the line and he's asked to do a tribute show for JJ Delaney, he's more than happy to do it. And I think we saw a different side of Brian Cody in that interview.
It's really nice to hear him kind of so affable. It's not as if he's confrontational or in interviews, or unless you get him in the wrong mood. But it's rare that you see that side of Brian Cody, and especially you haven't seen him for, you know, he's been around for so long that what's rare is wonderful, I suppose. But I think Teacher's Pet is probably going a bit too far, maybe. But there's definitely loads of admiration there between them, and it's interesting because like you're reading a couple of the Kilkenny players' books in the last couple of years, for example. Henry Shefflin, who's like the greatest of all time, there was even, you know, you definitely detected some tension in their relationship. And Jackie Tyrrell is another one who's from the same club as Brian Cody. And he even like spoke at length about how kind of, you know, the relationship between them and how, you know, it was fraught with maybe with tension every now and again. So I think JJ Delaney is a little bit different. And of the current crop, I would say, or the more recent crop, I'd say Richie Hogan. I get that impression that he's kind of similar as well. But it's rare enough that you hear Brian talking like that, and it's all the better for it.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I think Henry and Jackie's problem is that they might have stayed 1 year too many, and they ended up not making the team, and there's tension there. JJ, of course, left after an All-Ireland win in 2014 when he was still... You know, he won an All-Star that year. So he never had any issues with Brian Cody, you know, kind of having to phase him out. So that's probably why the mutual love is still there. Another tribute show was to Meath legend Trevor Giles. one of my favourite players, what the only player to win Player of the Year twice, actually, Connor. You'll have great memories from 1996 when Trevor Giles burst onto the, well, he burst onto the scene, I think, in 1994 or 5. Anyways, I obviously had to ask him about him cutting off his jerseys into the Aussie rules style. So here he is explaining.
Night before the Leinster final, Ollie Murphy said to me, God, it'd be great if we'd sleeveless jerseys for the game tomorrow against Dublin, just for the crack, you know, and just set me mind thinking. And I went home and she'd have a load of number 11 jerseys at home in the bag, and I just cut the sleeves off and I said, I'll go with that. And that was it.
Right, but you didn't use your own jersey the next day, or did you cut one off the new jerseys that you'd get for that Leinster final?
Yeah, that's it. You know, you'd get a jersey every game, you know, so I had a number of Keepack Bank of Ireland number 11s, you know, so yeah, it was just one I'd worn probably the previous day, the semi-final, and cut the sleeves off. And then I didn't stick the jersey on to me until we were running out the tunnel, so I'm hoping to see. And I suppose it was very unlike me, you know, that wasn't my style at all to stand out.
But I thought, see, I had in my head maybe you're in the toilets cutting the jersey before the game and all this kind of thing. But like, I mean, would it have been a distraction for the final to be, you know, hiding the jersey in your bag and not putting it on before the match? Do you know?
No, you know yourself. Sometimes you'd be warming up in the dressing room in the club park. You mightn't have your jersey on. It'd be warm, it'd be hot, you know. So
yeah.
You might stick the jersey on before you go out, you know. But I'd spent a few minutes at home the previous night, the Saturday night. Didn't make a brilliant job of it when I had my handiwork.
Yeah, you left a bit of yellow or kind of a band of yellow after the green, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't get any calls from Louis Copeland subsequently asking me to join him. But I suppose it was just very unlike me, you know, but I suppose the way I look at it, I was coming back from cruciate ligament injury and I'd worked really, really hard. Like, I was putting in maybe 4 hours a day rehabilitation. I really wanted to get back playing, and I'd missed the game and I was hungry, you know, and I suppose I just felt that year, I have a load of work done here. I have more work done than any player in Ireland. You know, I've worked harder, I've put more into it, and confidence was high. And I suppose I felt just in that season, I can do this, that I can actually wear this jersey and still play really well, you know. So I'm not saying I had that confidence every year, but just that was my mindset at the time.
Like Trevor Giles says twice in that clip there, that it's not like me. It wasn't like me. I think he said it twice in that clip. He definitely said it twice in the interview, and he couldn't have said it any clearer. This was just completely not a Trevor Giles thing to do. This was a bit of a showman thing to do, which he absolutely wasn't. Like, he was just an absolutely brilliant player. And I don't care what anybody says. There is no way that you hiding a jersey in your bag, not putting it on until the tunnel so that your manager can't see it and going out in the field, there is no way that couldn't be a distraction to you going out in the field. And he wins Player of the Year.
Obviously, he didn't bother Trevor Giles, will he? Do you know? But that's what I was thinking as well, is that, like, he... So Trevor Giles was a classy centre forward, and you know, like, there are some centre forwards who are classy as well, who are shapers. You know, shapers is the word I'm reaching for into the bargain, but he definitely wasn't. Like, if I could think of anyone like that might be a shaper from that Mead team, maybe Graham Geraghty, but definitely not Trevor.
He was not a shaper. I won't accept
it. Well, okay, well maybe not, but maybe more of one than Trevor Giles. But like, in fairness to him, it wasn't as if, like, it was a fairly crude cut. Do you know, like, it wasn't as if it wasn't the height of fashion the way he cut the sleeves. So I don't think it was a fashion statement. And in fairness to him as well, like, Trevor Giles was no weakling, but you know, some people might have done it maybe to show off their biceps, whatever. Like, he was no weakling, but they weren't exactly bulging out either. So I don't think it was him trying to do that either. But listen, it did. The lengths that he went to kind of nearly came as a surprise, but. But he was obviously so mentally kind of sure of himself that it was never going to bother him, and it obviously didn't.
Yeah, and Sean Boylan forbid him from doing it for the final. The county board were getting fined for it and all sorts of stuff, and he stuck to his guns and wore it for the final. I'm just thinking, with his kind of milk bottle coloured skin and his lack of muscles, and I'm thinking the man that should have been doing that was Colin McManaman back in 96. Like, he's that tank, his body is built to be doing stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, the real shame for Colin McManaman is that he played in an era before player fit. So the player for jersey. So I think you'll remember, was it Armagh or Kildare that that purposely got
Armad started that
like that, yeah, to show off their biceps, whereas Colin McManaman's biceps were shown through a jersey that was hanging off most people. He was that much his guns were that much in shape. But yeah, what a player as well. Maybe not quite as classy as Trevor Giles, but an all-round very good at number 11 as well.
Yeah, I think that's putting it mildly, not as classy as Trevor Giles. All right, so last of the lockdown tribute shows now. This one was from one of my favourite players in hurling and football, Brian Corcoran. Really enjoyed this one. Like Brian Corcoran's absolute hatred for playing cornerback in football, it just kind of made me laugh. I don't think it's in this clip, but if you want to listen back to it, it's a really good tribute show. Anyway, here he is describing how his comeback in 2004 came about. So there's one man in Cork people have to thank.
Back in 2003, Donal O'Grady had taken over, and he rang me to know whether I'd come back. And I told him I wouldn't come back, and thanked him for the offer. But I was done, and I was finished.
And what triggered you to change your mind then?
Yeah, it's funny because Cork got to the All-Ireland in 2003 against Kilkenny, and I was sitting in the upper deck of the Hogan, and I was happy to be there. I was comfortable to be there. I was, sometimes it's not really until the big day when you realize, oh, have I made a mistake here? But I was quite happy sitting up in the stand, because, not saying I wouldn't have liked to have been down there, but when you think of the nine months of hard work it would take to have gotten there, I wouldn't have swapped it. So I was happy in sitting in the stand. Cork lost the game. I went back out to City West just to give my condolences to the team. I actually parked out there and I got the bus in, so I waited for the team, and I was just about head home, so I kind of spoke to some of the players and walked out the door, and I was just about to get into my car to drive back to Cork, and Tom Barry, who was a great Corkman living in Dublin, was the organizer of the social event that evening, and he came back out and he followed me out and he said, would you like to come into the social? And I said, like, I was wearing a jersey and I didn't have any other clothes with me, and I said, I've only got a jersey on me. And he said, oh, who cares? Come on in. So he brought me in, and I actually ended up sitting with the players and kind of spent the evening with the players. And the following evening, when they came back in the train, I kind of met them again and went out. And it just triggered something. So literally within 24 hours, it kind of triggered something within me in terms of, maybe there's a spark here somewhere. And after seeing 2003, I was pretty, don't know what it was, but I just, I, in my own mind, I felt Cork were going to win the All-Ireland in 2004. And then it was kind of, okay, do I want to be involved in that? And obviously there was no guarantees of even getting back on the panel and getting back on the team. There was a new excitement around there because, Setanta Halpine was on the team, and there was a new style, and so that was kind of exciting. So I kind of made my own mind up that I'd start training again.
Okay, so Tom Barry, I'd never heard of Tom Barry before. So Brian Corcoran's out in the car park with his Cork jersey on after watching Cork lose, and Tom Barry follows him out and talks him into coming back into the function. Brian Corcoran connects with a lot of these young players that have come through. They have a pint. He meets them again the next night, and the rest of the history. Two All-Irelands later with Brian Corcoran at full forward. Tom Barry, take a bow.
Yeah, and if you Google Tom Barry, you'll be finding information about a very different Tom Barry, let's just say. But but fair play to Tom Barry, is right, Willie. But I just think from listening back to Brian mention it there, I just wonder, he sounds to me like he was fairly easily persuaded anyway. So he went to the banquet, and then he went on the beer with the Cork lads on the Monday, and then he reckons that by the end of those 2 days that he was ready to go. And listen, fair play to him, because the vast majority of promises that are made after 2 days of the beer are never followed up on. So fair play.
That is a very fair point. I'll ring you tomorrow. I'll ring you during the week. Okay, one of the more left field interviews we did this year was with Normal People actor Paul Mescal. He's not just a Normal People actor, he's an actor in lots of things now because he's a worldwide fame, but he's obviously a very good GAA pedigree as well, playing underage with Kildare. I love normal people. I think that was during the March lockdown, was it?
Was, yeah.
Around that time, yeah. Well, I got into it anyway. I remember looking up Paul on Twitter. Well, I might have been looking up his co-star first, but then I looked up Paul. But anyways, it turns out Paul Mescal followed me on Twitter, and I was like, geez, yeah, that's nice. And so I sent him on a message anyways, and it turns out he was a big fan of the show. A lot of this interview is me being completely out of my depth, talking about acting stuff. So you can have a listen.
I think it's naive to think that like people in secondary schools aren't having sex. I think the important angle of the conversation is that consent is being discussed amongst like school children. Like, and they're not school, like they're young adults. They just happen to be wearing school uniforms. But I think, look, it's probably something that will take a couple of years to kind of redress the balance. And yeah, if the positive thing is that it is sparking the conversation, like you're seeing, I'm hearing of like parents talking about those scenes with their children, and that's a real positive for me from the show.
Yeah, it is. With spare a thought for the children who are watching it with their parents, hoping that the scene ends any second.
And they certainly aren't short, so I apologize.
Kabir, did you audition for the role? Like, would there have been sex scenes in the audition, or, you know, how did that come about?
Oh, Jesus, no, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't be doing that in the audition, but...
How would they know you were able to ask that out there?
No,
that's a stupid question.
We have to do... Yeah, it is a little bit, but I'll take it that acting isn't your forte. But, no, we have to... The first audition I did by myself with the casting director, and then I met Lenny in the second audition, and then I did a couple of chemistry reads with potential Marianne in the third and fourth audition. So it's a long enough process, and it's kind of it's the highly charged and highly stressful time, because you're kind of, nothing is guaranteed, but you feel like you're making positive steps towards the character and you're not trying to get ahead of yourself. But yeah, it's a tricky time mentally, I suppose.
I don't know, Connor, was that like the most stupid question? I still kind of stand by that question a little bit, in that you're going in to play a role with a lot of sex scenes in it. What if you freeze in the sex scene? Should the sex scene not be part of the audition? Paul thought that was a hilariously stupid question. And I'm still kind of scratching my head wondering, how was it?
Well, I would have thought it was a fairly stupid question, Woolly, before I watched Normal People. And then you see the level of detail that they go into. Without elaborating, the level of detail that they go into in the sex scenes, they leave very little to the imagination. So I'd be a little on your side there, but I did have to say I had a good laugh at picturing Paul Mescal going into an audition and being told, here, listen, there's going to be a lot of sex scenes, so show us what you got there. You know, that seems a little bit strange to me. But just when you say out of your depth, Woolly, I don't know, I seem to recall you playing a siren role in a music video there lately for Better Plunkett's Brothers Band, and you were quite good at it. But maybe that was because it was someone on the run from the law, so that might have been a kind of natural role.
Very, very, very good at running away from people, Connor. If you want to throw the law in there, look, I'll just have to accept that. The Lost Messiahs video, that was. And there was a part two as well, Connor. So like, I was so good in the very first one with my acting. I got killed twice. I got killed in the second episode, in the second song, and in the first one. Anyways, listen, we'll leave it there for part one, and we'll see you in a minute.
Come here, I want you to talk us through the goal you scored in the county final after 15 seconds. I want you to tell me when you had goal on your mind.
Yeah, you've probably had a few 15 seconds experiences yourself. Break me off, show me what you got, because I don't want no 1 minute
man. All right, welcome back to the best of 2020 on the GER. So Colm Kavanagh retired this year after a brilliant career with Tyrone. It was a bit of a surprise, really, because he had played some of the games before lockdown in the league and then retired before the championship. And obviously the championship was being run off so quickly, you know, it was a surprise to a lot of people why he wouldn't have continued on. Anyways, maybe it was just a surprise to me. I don't know. Well, he joined us on the show after he announced the retirement, and we got talking about his role as a sweeper.
and how teams didn't actually ever figure out how to handle him?
Probably actually was. I'm sure you were nearly always waiting for somebody to do something different to throw you off your game. Now, Donegal did try it. What year was it? I'm not sure of the year, but the put a big tall fella and he came running in and he stood on top of me.
Right.
And actually marked me in one of the championship games. But it didn't really pay off on that day because, I don't know, whatever guy came in, he didn't really make any runs. He sort of stood beside me, but I was still able to actually execute what I was doing because he wasn't actively trying to really run for the ball. He just ran in top of me and nearly stand beside me. Like, but
I get you, yeah.
Now, it sort of, that was probably the only one and only time where, well, not one and only, to be fair to Dublin, they sort of were able to play around me many today. And that obviously happened when big days where, they were just cute enough to be able to pull me out of position and get into scoring positions to be able to execute. So, but apart from that, there's a lot of teams were happy enough to let me stand there, and I was happy enough to do it.
Was that the day against Dublin? Was it 2017 where they beat you in the semi final, where you kind of realised, right, these lads are being too patient now. We're getting none of the turnovers we used to get. They're picking us off, and they were able to find that space.
Yeah, they were and they were able, the way they were sort of nearly probing down the wings and coming in around the loops, and then they were finding wee pockets in front of the D. So it was very hard for me if I was pushing out. On that day, then would left holes in behind, then we get in behind, and then if I didn't push out, they were just taking shots from the D, from the top of the D, and putting them straight over the bar, and I was too slow at coming out. So, I got found out a few times probably, and probably Dublin being the best at it in terms of being able to pick around that system, and obviously they'd played against it numerous times. Every team does it against them to try and hold them off, and I say they were very good at it every time we went out. But we tried to adopt it, and I tried to adopt how I positioned myself and how I tried to impact it a wee bit more. But to be honest, more days than not, I was on the wrong side of it, in terms of my own performance, which sort of annoyed me a bit.
Well, against Dublin maybe, but against most others, that role worked absolutely brilliantly for Tyrone. Come here, what do you make of your all-star at full-back? You're a full forward, like you say, you're a midfielder, you're a wing forward, you're an all-star full-back. What do you think of that? I'm sure Sean slags you about that.
No, he does. But it's hard. In terms of, you're delighted to win. From a player point of view, you're delighted to pick up anything. I've said to every single person I'm talking to, you don't play for these awards, but they are nice and you have to really cherish them. So, to be honest, position-wise, I don't really care. Whether right or wrong or different, I'm sort of happy just to be. I was happy to be there and happy to take the position. Obviously, there was a lot of stuff about it. I think that year with me getting full back, but there was other players on that panel, on that All Star team, were playing. I think that got all sorts of positions that weren't playing as well. So I think just the full back one for me was pretty highlighted because I was a midfielder and I wasn't a full back. But I think if you look back through it, there was a couple other fellas, one or two in particular, that were in positions. Got all sorts of positions that they weren't playing either. It's the type of system where you have to be there. The positions nowadays don't really matter in a way because a cornerback can come up and kick as many points as a corner forward, and the corner forward can be as good a tackler in the team back in defence. So referring to people as individuals positions at the minute, I think is very, very difficult because there's a lot of guys that can do it all.
Yeah, so an all-star at full-back, Conor, I can imagine Sean slagging him. He's got his all-stars and Colm has one at midfield and one at full-back. I don't care what anybody says. It has to be a little bit strange, and Colm didn't go into it too much, but to have an all-star at full-back when you never played full-back, you never had to mark anybody, which is what two rows of full-back has to do. And, it's a situation where very, very surprisingly, and he admits that only Donegal kind of half-heartedly sent somebody in on him. So he had a free role in there, gets an all-star at full-back. I'm not going to start getting in, giving out about all-stars here now, maybe not. We'll talk about Colm Kavanagh.
Yeah, that's definitely a debate for another day, Willie. The only thing I'll say is that the sign that he got an all-star at full-back is kind of a testament to how he had made that role into his own and how identifiable he was with that. But that was as much down to, as he admitted himself, that was as much down to, in a lot of cases, the opposition. You mentioned Donegal there. The idea, if you're going to put somebody in on somebody who's minding the full back line, is to work them. And Donegal didn't work them. They just threw somebody in on him and just to try and distract him, but didn't have him move around the place. And actually, although he wasn't playing the role at the time, one of the main ones that stands out to me is when Mayo put Alan Dillon on Joe McMahon in 2016 to prevent Rowan having that spare man at the back. But ultimately, Woolley, like the problem with that, and fair play to Colm, he's honest about it, is because they were playing playing that way for so long, when they played against Dublin then, who were way too cute to fall for it, it was too late for them to change tack. And, you know, that ultimately cost them pretty much big time in two big games against Dublin in the semi-final in 2017 and the final in 2018.
Yeah. And like, I mean, a few different counties are doing it now, dropping midfielders back. Donegal is the one that sticks out with Hugh McFadden. He drops back into that. He should be very proud that we call it the Colm Kavanagh role, I suppose, for a midfielder. But like, I get blue in the face talking about why a team didn't send somebody in on him. And Donegal are sending in a midfielder just to stand beside him. You send somebody in to mark Colm Kavanagh, make a few runs. Colm Kavanagh simply has to track those runs because he's in a dangerous position on the field and he can't cover. I just don't get it. I'm not going to labour it anymore because I've talked about it on the show absolutely way too much over the last few years. We'll move on because the first county final took place again in another lockdown. This is a similar team and we're still in one, Connor, I suppose. It took place in Wexford. Let's keep the spirits up here, lads. Let's stay positive, right? It's very difficult for me, but we'll try and stay positive. So the first county final took place in Wexford. And obviously it was behind closed doors. And I think that was kind of at the start of these closed doors things. It was very weird. Simon Donoghue was the captain of Shelmaliers. You know, when he lifted the cup to just seeing a few players, we're well used to it now, you know, it's nothing major now, but that day I just thought it was very unusual. Simon gave us a good interview about, you know what it was like, because he had won a county title before with obviously his friends and family and the club supporters running onto the field. But he said an interesting thing in the speech, and I hadn't heard it in a speech before. He says, "I'm not going to give Navena three cheers because it's a bit childish." And I thought, just watching it, geez, that's just fantastic. I'm going to have to give Simon Donoghue a ring tomorrow. So he joined us on the show on Monday, and here he is explaining it.
Luckily, I've been in a couple of finals and I've lost a couple, and I don't like myself, just this from personal, not a fan of the three cheers, because you're after giving your all if you're after losing, and all you want to, you don't want to hear a hip hip hooray kind of, you're like, yeah, well done, you're best today and thanks very much for the game kind of, more so than, I just felt that, like you said, it's a bit patronising, but that's my opinion. Other people might say it's nice to do for the team, but look, I made a decision and I have to go with it now, anyway.
So I think this has taken off, Connor. Like, I mean, Cluxton didn't do it. Declan Hannan didn't do it in their All-Ireland speeches. I have heard it very, very little. I've seen, I'm fairly sure Connor Sweeney didn't do it in his speech after winning Munster. So it's definitely taken off, that this old-fashioned three cheers for the losing team, which is perfectly fine if you're in an under 12 county final, but grown senior in the county adults don't need to be patronised and get three cheers and make a horrible experience of losing even worse.
Yeah, should we give Simon Donoghue the credit for this? I mean,
can you remember anyone before?
That's it. I'm like you. I genuinely can't remember. And the thing about it is that because it's formed a part of the winner's speech for so long, it's nearly like people are expected to do it. It's nearly like, you know, they don't give it a second thought. It's just something that you do, is give the opposition three cheers. And childish, yes. What I would say is just, it's a bit token. Willie, you know, there's no real genuity to it. Like, you know, like losing teams might want to hear anything from the opposition, but they certainly don't want to hear something that's patronizing. And definitely the three cheers kind of can fall into that. And there's often a case where something that a winning captain might say to a losing team, it mightn't hit home at the time, but once you have a chance to reflect on it, you might come back and say, well, actually, fair play to him for saying that. It was from the heart and he meant it, as opposed to just giving three cheers for the sake of it. So by the looks of it, with Declan Hannan, Stephen Cluxton, Conor Sweeney seems to have taken on. So fair play to Simon Donoghue and long may it continue.
Yeah, I'm not sure they had O'Shea. I don't think his speech was actually televised that day, was it? I don't remember it anyways, or maybe
it was very short, because I know that he literally lifted the cup and then he had to hand it straight back afterwards. I don't think the Mayo lads even got to share around. So, and it wasn't on, I don't know why it wasn't on TV. Was there an undergame after it that day? But it was very, very, very short and sweet.
Yeah, no, and the Cavan one as well. I'm trying to think back. Anyways, I would do away with the speeches altogether, because, like, I mean, you look at the stage now, the backroom teams are so big and they all have to get tanked. And then you have Declan Hannan. I saw him getting a lot of credit for his speech. I waited around for his speech. I didn't wait around for Stephen Cluxton, because, like, no, I'm not trying to slag Stephen Cluxton at all. That's just the way he is. You were never going to get a good speech out of him. But Declan Hannan then is thanking everyone, and then he's thanking the frontline staff. And I was just like going, yawn. This is like, what is this? If there was a crowd in this stadium, you would be sucking the life out of them. I always find that with when the cup is lifted, everyone's jumping around. And now, at the end of these modern acceptance speeches, people are just like, they've sucked that kind of, you know, electricity out of the crowd. And it's almost like bringing your own supporters back down. Lift the bloody cup, have the fans give a big cheer and jubilation, and get the hell down and do a lap of honour. That's what I say. Like, whether that'll happen or not, I don't know. Connor, the story of the year, arguably for me, was Cavan. An absolutely crazy team this year who were brilliant and brutal in their games leading up to the Ulster final. They actually were brilliant right throughout the Ulster final. We spoke to Killian Clark about the celebrations. Again, the usual team. We're in the middle of a lockdown. Cavan's fans are absolutely crazy. And how they dealt with the celebrations.
We come back through obviously Monaghan Town when you're coming from Armagh and through Smithsboro, and you know there's bonfires and flags, and you know probably people coming over from Cotill or the Monaghan side of Cavan, if you want to say, and meeting right. us along the road. And people, you know, droves of people kind of out in their numbers, probably just families kind of sticking together more so than anything else. Yeah. And then in through Butler's Bridge and the streets mobbed in Butler's Bridge a wee bit. And then, you know, we kind of convoyed into Breffni Park. Then we lifted the cup with the squad at about 9 o'clock. You know, there's, you know, 40 odd members of the extended panel, obviously, that couldn't have been there in Armagh due to the restrictions, which is highly disappointing from a player's perspective. But you know, we said I think the plan was to wait to lift the cup until we got to Breffni. But you know, those plans were changed just by officials in Armagh after the game. But every man got to lift the cup. Every man got to, you know, share that moment with their family. Only family members were allowed into the grounds itself. Close right. family members, you know, three or four people per family. I think Killian the Gunner might have had maybe 20 people because he's that many relations in his family too. So. There was a few more on his side of things, but everyone got to lift the cup and share a few moments with the family and a few pictures and that in Breffni Park. And then we got up onto a lorry and there was a drive through done, so we were on the back of the lorry for about 3 hours after that. I think we finished up at 12 o'clock.
So they're on the back of a lorry for about 3 hours, Connor. I have a great picture in my head of that. And I think, to be fair, it was some fantastic planning by the Cavan management or the Cavan County Board, whoever planned it, to obviously had no friends, family, anyone in Armagh, to come back to Breffni Park, to have the cup there, to lift the cup in front of friends and family, get a few pictures, and then go on the back of a lorry and have a drive-through where fans drove past in their cars and beeped the horn at them. Like, I mean, that's very, very good planning. And this is from a team going in as massive underdogs going into that final.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's obviously not the same as them having 20,000 Cavan people in Armagh to celebrate the Ulster, you know, winning their first Ulster since, I think, in 97, was it, or something like that? You know,
97, yeah.
Scene. But at the same time, geez, this is something that anyone that was involved in that will look back on in years and years to come because of how unique it was. And like, in fairness, like, you talked to the about how good the planning was, and the Cavan County Board or whoever responsible deserve a lot of credit for that. And to be fair, it was a lot more than a lot of teams got to do. You know, like, to, because in a lot of cases, I think I mentioned it there, you know, Mayo won the Connacht title. Like, Aidan O'Shea got to lift the cup and immediately had to hand it back to the Connacht Council Secretary. It wasn't even a case. He couldn't even give it to his teammates, and I don't think they were allowed photos to be taken, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I know it wasn't much, but at least that the Cavan lad did get to celebrate with their families and stuff like that. And just the whole, there would have been such a novel element to being in the back of a lorry as well. So, like, again, something that they're going to look back on in years to come and remember really fondly.
Yeah, a freezing element. Maybe Ulster just said no. Ulster says no to handing back the cup. Well, how did that happen that Cavan got to keep the cup? Maybe was that one of the first ones? No, the Connacht one was the first one.
Yeah,
anyways,
I
don't know how they got away with that. Right, we'll leave it there, Connor. That's it for part two, and we'll come back for the last part three.
I'd never be allowed to go off and eat and have a shite, like, and go off a slob or whatever. Like, I was always doing a bit.
All I remember is I thought I was going to get clobbered on the way in there. I threw the ball up in there. I don't know, it was pure luck, no, in fairness. Pure luck. It's fucking bullshit, as you've seen yourselves.
All right, welcome back to the best of the GAA in 2020. It's not often, Conor, you get a member of the Dublin backroom team, under Jim Gavin especially, giving us some insights into their setup. We had Declan Darcy on the show. He came on the show to look back as one of those nostalgia shows back in March in that lockdown. And we're looking back at the famous Leitrim win in the 94 Connacht final. Obviously, that was my way into getting Declan on the show. I just wanted to talk about Dublin. Here he is. I'm joking to all the Leitrim fans. Here's Declan explaining, at least I think he is, explaining the famous Dublin process.
Yeah, sometimes, Jim, obviously you guys would love Jim, but he wasn't a million miles off, to be honest. And everybody was kind of thinking, he's only pulling that out of the hat there. And he's kind of just saying that. But a lot of it was. And, when you think about it, the players are in that bubble and they were functioning really, really well. And the exceptional bit about them was, in the White Heat Championship football, a lot was at stake. And at any stage, you're talking about two in a row, three in a row, then the final. There was a lot of chips on the table and a lot of pressure when it came to certain games, as you've seen. And were they able and capable of functioning correctly? And I think a lot has to do with that process piece and what it looked like to them. But don't forget, it might work for this particular group of players, which it did really, really well. It mightn't work for every group of players, but it certainly gave us huge traction and actually being able to perform at the really, really key moments of the games. Guys didn't lose focus of what they had to do, and it was a brilliant, brilliant piece. And then to see them executing it, particularly in the All-Ireland final last year, the drawing game, when it was a lot at stake and things not going their way, they still had the mindset to function really, really well.
Impressive stuff from Declan there. Kind of gets you thinking a little bit, Conor. And it sounds to me like, I don't know if that's the process, it just kind of sounds like, Jim says sticking to the process. And there's a couple of matches stand out to me when you think about, right, we're not going to get panicked about losing this game. Let's just stick to trying to play well and do the things that we're good at and do all those kind of things. And I'm thinking of the Lee Keegan goal. I'm thinking about the last injury time against Kerry, going for the five in a row. There's other examples as well, especially against Mayo, I suppose, in those games, that there's no panic ever for Dublin. And do you think that this kind of thing that they're drilling into them, that this actually had an effect, and this is a reason why they don't panic or they don't do stupid things, that they're not really, really panicked about losing? Can you believe that players can be programmed that way?
I believe that the Dublin players can be programmed that way. Just because they have the evidence to back it up. I mean, one of my most hated phrases in the GAA is stick to the process, and it's purely because it's overused. And it's this copycat culture in the GAA that, Dublin talk about sticking to the process, so we're going to stick to the process. Now, that's not to say that there's nothing of value in sticking to the process, but I think that other teams just throw it out there. Just to be heard to be saying it and not really back it up, whereas there's concrete evidence that Dublin do it. So, you mentioned, they were the two examples I was thinking of. 2019 against Kerry down the stretch in the drawn game, when I think they were down to 40, Dublin were down to 14 men at that stage. Stephen Cluxton had come out to mark one of the Kerry full forward line, so Dublin could continue to execute that press down the closing stretch when they were down by a point. And Lee Keegan's, obviously Lee Keegan's goal, James McCarthy came back and kicked a point after that. And obviously Dean Rock eventually got the winner. But the manner of the scores that they got in that Mayo game, for example, they could have been scoring that when they were 5 points up in the first half, as opposed to being in the 60th minute with a point down. And I think when I say that I believe the Dublin players can be programmed that way, I haven't seen evidence or much evidence of any other teams, especially in football, that can nearly have set plays or nearly so sure of themselves that they don't get affected by emotion the way that other teams do. So that's they have evidence to support what Declan Darcy, who, to be fair to him, I hate the term, but he explained it really well there.
He did, actually. And it's like them having ice in their veins, and it must have worked. Now, I do think that Kerry injury time was almost helter skelter, was almost like either we do, it was almost manic. I don't know if that was really necessarily, I think all bets had gone out the window at that stage. It was almost just like, Jesus, we just simply have to, it was survival kind of instincts kicked in with Dublin that time. But I'm thinking of the James McCarthy point. I think it was directly after that Lee Keegan goal back in that game. And it was like, he sent that out on his wrong side, maybe I don't know, 2 meters to the wrong side of the post and brought it back in. This was like something you do in training before a match. Like this, you know, like, I mean, definitely drill. This is sports psychology, I suppose, that Darcy and Jim Gavin are doing rather than, you know, necessarily anything tactical.
Yeah, you could say it was because James McCarthy is such a quality player and you'd rely on him in that situation. But I would have fancied the vast majority of the Dublin team to do the exact same thing and to have the confidence to do the exact same thing, because they've been drilled to do that, to rely on their skills and rely on, you know, to have that composure, whether it's, as I said, like the first half of a Leinster Championship game when they might be cruising by 10 points, or the 17th minute of an All-Ireland final. And so while other counties can talk about sticking to process and stuff like that, it's that execution of it when it really matters that they really have to aspire to. And I don't know, like I've yet to see that in any team really beyond Dublin. So I think while I might dismiss it when other teams say, when Dublin people talk or Dublin players talk about sticking to the process, they have the evidence to back it up.
Yeah, they definitely have. So Waterford had a brilliant year under Liam Cahill. Obviously, they reached the All-Ireland final. He made some brave calls when he took over, as is well documented now. He dropped 2 All-Stars without even giving him a trial match. One of them, Maurice Shanahan, joined us on the show not long after he was dropped, and he had a brilliant club campaign, and he filled us in on how it happened.
When you rang me, I was on a side with the home extra, to be honest, on Saturday evening.
So, do you remember the phone call?
I can remember it just about, to be honest with you. But look, he just said there's no reasons really. To be honest, he didn't give us a reason, to be honest with you. He just said myself and Noel were gone off the panel, and he said there could be one or two more, but it didn't work out like that. It was just myself and Noel, the two that got the bullet, I suppose, and maybe from the backlash, because there was a small bit of backlash in Waterford at the time, that it was just the two of us. Maybe he didn't go through with the others, but we'll never know that, I suppose.
Right, right. And he said that you were both respectful when they rang him up. Like, did you question him on anything, or what were you? Like, I suppose you're at the stag, so you're probably trying to get off the phone rather than keep the conversation going.
Yeah, to be honest, I suppose kind of took me back, to be honest with you, Colin, do you know, because yeah, just for the two of us to go, and then a week or two later you hear the 50 lads in there training, getting a trial and all this, and myself and Noel, after giving so much we did to Waterford, that we didn't even get a chance to prove ourselves to Liam, even if we're in there 5 or 6 weeks, and he turned around and said, look lads, you're not up to it. You couldn't argue with the man, I suppose. But look, I suppose like every manager has their way to play it. But we'll see now over the next few months, did he get it right, I suppose.
So, like, I mean, I'm trying to make sense of it. For hurling reasons, I'm not Liam Cahill, and he's his own man, and he knows the type of players he wants. I wouldn't see the hurling reasons. There was a lot of rumours coming out of Pádraig Fanning's squad last year and rumblings with players. Like, I mean, did that involve you and Noel, for example? Like, is that something Liam could have heard about and maybe not wanted you in for different reasons outside of hurling?
Yeah, I suppose. Look, I suppose last year with Pádraig, there's a lot of talk outside the county that a lot of players aren't happy in this, but I was inside the camp and no one kicked up, to be honest with you, Colin. You know, no one kind of questioned the way people were saying it either. Like, you know, rumours yourself, and people had legs to stuff. And to be honest with you, as players, last year we had to take a lot of criticism as well. And like, I don't think Liam could say that myself and Noel were causing trouble inside that camp, because we definitely didn't, to be honest with you.
Right, okay. So, like, I mean, yeah, there's not... Do you have any theory on why yourself and Noel went? Like, I presume you're in contact with each other after it happened and stuff. Like, I mean, have you any theory on it? Without being any way critical of Liam, because he's his own decision to make, have you got a theory on where it could have come from or what, you know, happened?
No, I actually don't, because, to be honest, like, for Liam to come in and just get rid of 2 players, that's like... You say something to you as a Waterman and came in because he'd be at all the Waterford games, you know, he'd be at all the club games.
Yeah, you see, he has Waterford selectors though, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, you know, he has 2 selectors from Waterford. One is from Ballygunner and one is from Ballyduff Upper, so I don't know.
So is there anything, you don't know if there's anything in that potentially?
The two of them will be rivalry clubs to myself and Noel, but I wouldn't think anything came out of that either, to be honest, but you never know. I just find it very hard for a man to come in from Tipperary and just get rid of two lads.
I got a bit obsessed with this story at the time, Conor. Like, I was like, Liam Cahill's making a big mistake here. Like, especially with the Boris Shanahan one, especially in the club form he was in. What do I know anyways? Like, I mean, obviously, Liam Cahill had his own plans and his own style of play, and maybe the lads didn't fit in. But Morris is definitely, it's a head scratcher with Morris at the time. He was very honest in the interview. And he, like, even asking him, were you a problem the year before? You were Noel. And he's like, no, we weren't. There weren't even that many problems. You know, like, according to him, it's definitely a weird one. And I had to laugh when he talked about the Waterford selectors being from Ballygunner and Ballyduff Upper, yeah, his local rivals of him and Noel. I was like, you know, I just laughed. And, you know, who knows what happened? But it wouldn't be without precedent for selectors from a rival club to say, look, he's only trouble.
You couldn't have done more to get to the bottom of why he was. I'll give you that, to be fair, listening back to it this morning and even getting Morris to admit that he was on a stag when he received the call. And fair play to Morris for admitting that as well. Listen, you'd like to think that the selectors being involved in rival clubs had nothing to do with it.
I'm only slagging about that. Like,
one of the beauties of, I suppose, of being an outside manager like Liam Cahill is that, and I'm sure, you know, whether Liam Cahill wouldn't be afraid to make big calls, even if he was, you know, involved with his native Tipperary. But you can make calls like that without having to worry maybe about the ramifications within your own club. But listen, Liam Cahill can look back in the season. Waterford had a brilliant season. Didn't go well for them in the final. So he can, you know, he can be happy with the decision he's made. But I don't know. I'm not a huge hurling man, but I'm still not convinced that it was necessarily the right one. As I said, like, they, whatever about deciding to do it after maybe giving them a chance, given what they've done, and especially after Morris Shannon's club form, but to do it beforehand, it was nearly like he was saying, well, I have to make a statement here and this is how I'm going to do it. These lads have been a part of the panel for so long, and if I cut these, this shows the rest of the panel that, like, no senior players are safe. So listen, as I said, Liam Cahill has had the season he's had. He can be happy with it, but I don't know, if I was Morris or Noel, I'd still maybe be a little bit aggrieved.
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I still disagree with it. But of course, after the year Waterford have, you have to just keep your mouth shut and say nothing or else. Yeah. you've definitely been proved wrong. Right, to finish up with the best of, one of my favourite interviews this year is with Seamus Flanagan, who spoke to us very recently after Limerick's All-Ireland win. I have to say, the Limerick fellas, when you see them being interviewed, Garrod, Hegarty or any of them really, they don't tie themselves in knots trying to be cagey. They just speak naturally. You know, they don't have any of that kind of media training. They don't look to have anyways. They seem to speak kind of off the cuff and whatever they think. Here's Seamus telling us about making it back onto the team, obviously this year for the All-Ireland semi-final.
I think I started out the season, we had the trips abroad and stuff, and we came back in and we were rolling straight back into league. And I think I kind of struggled to find my form again in 2019.
Right.
And I think it was just there was no pre-season as such. It was a case of we came back from our team holiday and it was straight back into training. And it was very much a case of that, you know, if once you needed to hit the ground running, and that didn't really happen for me. And I remember I rolled my ankle twice. I did the hamstring. I came on against Cork, I think, in the first round. They beat us and I did my hamstring, and we were after using our last sub, so I had to stay on. So that obviously aggravated that more.
Right.
And then it was just kind of a series, I think, of a culmination of things, to be honest. I just struggled to find form. And when you say impact sub, I don't think I really made much of an impact in 2019. And not getting to come on in the semi-final then was a massive, I think, driving force for me to push on in 2020. And the way things that panned out then, obviously, you know, we weren't sure if there was a championship going to go ahead, but I really carried that form through into the club. And, you know, we went to a county semi-final only to be beaten by a point by Napiershig. So I was, I just kind of carried that form through. And I was just kind of, I think I went back to my old roots in 2018 and, you know, that kind of youthful and carefree and, you know, let's do everything to the best of our ability and not really think too much about things.
Right, yeah, maybe. And that definitely showed when you came on. Like, were you surprised to get the start then against Galway? Because, like, I was predicting it on the show based on how well you did against Doughy Burke. You know how intimidating a player he can be, that you ran him around in 2018. And I was thinking maybe that would be a great game for you to start again. Were you expecting that call-up?
No, I wasn't. And I only kind of found, I suppose, Kylie keeps his cards close to his chest. And, you know, you don't really know where you stand as regards team basis. But I was just thinking to myself, look, the boys won the Munster final in against Waterford. You know, it's very hard to change a winning team. So I was prepping myself for, you know, coming on for those last 15, 20 minutes and just making that impact that I had been making, would say, throughout the season. And that's where I was mentally. And I think on the Tuesday night, then we usually run through a few kind of the 15 on 15, and you know, it's only 15 minutes towards the end of it. And I remember he was calling out the teams, and I remember he had called Dara at midfield with Will, and I was like, oh, Keane got the centre forward again for this game, because he'd switched back the week before.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's the change. And kind of, I think I said to one of the lads, I kind of zoned out and I looked up into the stand, and you know, the catering company had come in and the food was getting set up for after. And I was like, oh, what could we be having today? Is it curry or is it stew? And then all I heard was Aaron Gillan and Seamus Flanagan, and I looked over and I was like, that's a mistake. Surely that's a mistake. So I remember I went out in that session, and I think I was on Dan Morrissey, and I think I popped 1-3 off Dan, and just absolutely was like, right, if this is, you know, him trying something or something, I was like, oh, let's put the thought in his head. So that night went well for me. And then on the Friday came, and, you know, I was named as starting full forward. So absolutely over the moon. And as I said, I think the nerves probably kicked in then for me, being like, I needed to, you know, see my position. And luckily I did, and things kind of panned out the way that they did.
I have to say, like, I mean, Seamus Flanagan, it's an inspirational story of sticking with it, having a really bad year last year, coming back, still not getting back on the team, sticking in there, you know, and eventually getting his chance, playing brilliantly in the semi-final and brilliantly in the final. Like, I mean, it's a great story. That's not what I want to focus on here, though. And, like, obviously, Seamus Flanagan, I've said it a lot of times on the show, I really like him as a player. What I want to talk about is when he's waiting for the teams to be called out in the A versus B match. He's standing waiting for the team to get called out. He thinks he's going to be called out on the B team. The A team is being called out. He's dreaming. He's looking up into the stand wondering, are they going to have stew or curry that night? That's what I have to admit. I absolutely knew exactly where he was coming from. The amount of times I've daydreamed about what will be in there for us to eat after this training session.
I'd say his nutritionist didn't, or the Limerick nutritionist didn't probably thank him, because I don't know, maybe they are, and it doesn't matter what you eat after training, but I would have thought that there's far more healthier stuff to be eating than stew or curry. But
you must be joking. A good stew, are you for real? Less than bacon and cabbage, that's what you'd be reared on.
That's back in the 90s, Wally. We're talking about the 2020 here. Come on.
I'm healthy about a stew. Spuds, vegetables and meat and a bit of gravy, a bit of stew sauce.
I'm not saying it's unhealthy, Wally. I'm saying that if you go to an inter-county player's diet sheet these days, I doubt it features as prominently as it would have done with bacon and cabbage back in the day. That's all I'm saying.
Right, okay, I'll give you the curry, man. But look, at these lads burn so many calories during training. It's not too... Once they're getting the carbohydrates into them afterwards, you know, that's the most important thing. And the spuds and the rice with the curry or whatever. Like, I mean, in my experience, they're the type of dinners that you get when you come back in. But, like, I mean, it just shows how important... Like, I mean, that's something I completely related to straight away, is about the caterers coming in and what are you going to get and will it be nice? Like, I remember the thing that kind of jumped out to me was how pissed off Rio Ferdinand got when David Moyes came in and he banned his chips.
Yeah.
Rio Ferdinand, a grown man, was really pissed off. Like, I mean, this post-match meal, especially after training, because I suppose when you come up through the club scene, you never get it. And it's lovely then when you're in the county, that was nice now tonight. I don't know. Like, I mean, daydreaming about what's on the menu after training, I think this is very, very common.
To the extent Rio Ferdinand that time, that when Ryan Giggs came in as caretaker manager, was the first thing he asked him, and then they got their chips back. So
he reinstated the chips, yeah.
You can see how much of a big deal it was. But whatever about the food, well, it's only very rarely that we get treated to food after training. But I can relate to Seamus' story about, you know, when, say, if I was playing in the full back line or a half back line and you hear your name, and then it's like, right, you're on the team, and you zone out completely. And then you're walking out the dressing room door and you have to ask somebody, oh, geez, who's playing wing forward? Or you start the game and you realize that somebody isn't starting.
Yeah.
Like, geez, I didn't know that at all. So it is very easy to daydream in situations like that, for sure.
Oh, the minute your name is called out, any name after that, it will be forgotten immediately. Then it's just daydream time. You're in the mix and that's it. I remember with Portlaoise in 2004, there must have been a few quid going, because we'd never get food after training, but we were in we won the Leinster Club final and we're in the All-Ireland semi-final, and they used to get us pizzas after training, you know, and we'd all go into the kitchen in the clubhouse. The old clubhouse is gone now, and we'd eat a pizza. I found it a great eating food together after training, because you know the feeling in the shower, Connor, after a hard training session. There's a bit of bonding even will go on in the shower. You know, like, I mean, you've all gone through that together. There's a nice bit of closure for teams to eat together after a hard training session. I don't think club teams put enough emphasis, even if it's just a few sandwiches or a bit of soup. I think fellas let down their guard after a really hard training session. I don't know. Maybe it might be just for me. I just think that any club
should really look into keeping them together for that half hour after a good training session, because I think that's when the you know, a bit of crack, a bit of bonding actually happens.
Yeah, ye pampered lads with your pizzas in Port Leash, Willie. We had it a few years ago where we took it in turns. A player would have to make sandwiches every Friday night session, because there'd be lads down from college and stuff like that, whereas they mightn't be around during the week. And every Friday night, a player would take it in turns and maybe buy three loaves and make a lock of sandwiches. And so it just gets everybody. We had an area upstairs in our clubhouse as well, and we'd gather for 20, 25 minutes as well. And the thing is, like, you know, sometimes after training, the management might call you in for some sort of chat anyway. So rather than sitting in the dressing room, you were doing it above, where everyone was gathered and they were having their sandwiches. And then you have the bit of crack, as you say, afterwards, you know, get the bit of camaraderie going and stuff. But as long as, the only thing I'll say in that is, as long as this training session or any meetings or anything like that hasn't lasted for 2.5 or 3 hours already, and then you're looking at spending maybe another half an hour above. But I completely agree. I think it's really good for kind of building teamwork, or, you know, building a kind of team ethic and a team bond and stuff like that. And it's just, it's a pity it's probably not possible at the moment with everything that's going on. But once everything is back to normal, hopefully this will lead the charge to get it going again in maybe late 2021, 2022.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, that's it, Conor. That's it for the best of. The big question, I suppose, is who going into 2021? Can anyone stop Limerick or Dublin, Limerick from retaining their title, Dublin going for 7 in a row? I would be of the opinion no is the answer. So I mean, I don't know if that's the kind of a depressing way to leave the show. I'm sure you've been the dreamer that you are, will say it's Mayo for Sam again. You're just relentless, you boys.
Well, I was like that before the final, Willie, but then, like, with a tinge of realism, realizing that it was probably not going to happen, and that's how it panned out. But yeah, listen, if we can't dream, you know, what's the point? Do you know, there's no point, especially at the start of the season, bringing yourself to the realization that it's probably not going to happen for you. But if you were to ask me that question, can anyone stop Limerick or the Dubs, and I was to give you one word, it would be no in 2021.
Okay, two no's. We'll leave it at that. We'll talk to everybody next week. Good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So it opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know, and it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, 'cause I won't see you.